Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. This week, I'm joined by deputy online editor Faye Watson.
Heya.
And this week, we're going to be returning to Middle-earth with The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power Season 2. We're going to hear from the showrunners and cast of the Prime Video show, and we'll also be reviewing that. And we'll also be reviewing prison drama Sing Sing and Netflix anime series Terminator Zero. But before we get into those new releases, have you been watching anything else this week, Faye?
Yeah, actually kind of themed along with that, I've been rewatching Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I'm in Fellowship of the Ring and I've just about to start The Two Towers. And it's just been so much fun going back to those films.
You been going for the extended editions?
No, I haven't been going for the extended editions. I thought I'd kind of ease my way in. Maybe I can work up to the extended editions a little bit later in the year. Otherwise, along with The Rings of Power, that's an awful lot of Lord of the Rings, even for me.
I haven't watched them for so long. I watched them loads back in the day, but yeah, I can't remember the last time I did a full rewatch. It's always like a nice thing to do, like around Christmas, I always think, just get the original
Yes,
trilogy back on. I'm sort of tempted to revisit The Hobbit as well, because I broadly speaking enjoyed those films when they came out. I really liked the first one, I remember when it came out, and then less so the next couple. Yeah, I'm tempted to revisit them and see if, like, now with like the pressure off a bit, how they hold up, whether they hold up kind of slightly better than maybe they seemed at the time when there was all that weight of expectation, or whether it just seems like they were just a bit of a disappointment after the Lord of the Rings trilogy. But are they part of your rewatch or not?
Well, actually, yeah, I haven't watched them yet. I mean, if I'd thought about it logically, I could have done it in chronological order. But I'm the same as you. I think I might rewatch them as well because, I mean, I liked them at the time. I enjoyed watching them in the cinema and stuff. But yeah, they didn't really kind of ignite the same kind of imagination that the original films did for me. So I would be interested to kind of revisit them and see if, like, without kind of that comparison lingering so heavily over them, which I did in the kind of lead up to the release, whether they're the same.
Last week on the podcast, we didn't get a chance to review The Crow because it wasn't screened for critics at that point. But I believe you've actually had a chance to catch that now, haven't you?
Yeah. I managed to see it in the cinema on Friday. But kind of on a slightly more bum note, I didn't really enjoy The Crow very much. I think it goes for a different approach to the film than both the kind of 1994 adaptation and also the story in the original comic book as well, and focuses a lot more on the kind of origins of Eric and Shelley's relationship, and that takes up like almost about half, maybe even a little more of the film. And then you kind of get into the kind of revenge thriller aspect, which I did enjoy a lot more, but I think it was just a bit too slow getting into that for me. I don't think it's quite the calamity that has been suggested by some reviews, but it wasn't what I hoped it would be.
That's quite an unusual approach to take, isn't it, really? Because normally with kind of modern, I know this isn't strictly a remake, you know, it's a sort of a new adaptation of the comics material, but normally they would go much more in the action and get things started much more quickly. But unusual that it chose to take that opposite sort of approach. Is it very full on once it does get going?
I mean, yes, it is for like, it's a really great sequence kind of the action. It's set in like an opera, and Bill Skarsgård kind of goes kind of full John Wick and kills everybody. It really works well. It's like a really good sequence. And I just kind of wish there was more of that, because then it kind of ends quite abruptly after that, and there's not really a great deal more than just that. And given that the action was so great, and it, I mean, it's very much a 18 rated film, it's really violent, it just feels a bit strange that they didn't kind of lean more into that, because they've got the kind of ingredients there to make that really good, but they just went along a different route. I'm not really sure why.
Odd. I will try and catch it at some point, but yeah, I must admit it's not my very top priority based on what you've said and what else I've heard about it.
Yeah.
And it's been a bit of unsurprisingly, it seems to have flopped, doesn't it, at the box office. So it doesn't really feel like a film that will kind of be making much of an impact, you know, this year, or that will be really remembered anything like the original. Yes. And I, to be honest, I haven't really been watching much this week besides what we're going to be talking about. I did watch the first episode of The Last Leg for the Paralympics, because sort of excited about that gearing up. And I feel like with the Olympics and Paralympics, there's so much that it's just handy to have something that effectively wraps it up for you. So that to me is a good way of doing it because I just find it very funny as well. So I love all those guys kind of that host it. And that'll be the main thing keeping me going through it. And I will, by the time this goes out, I'm heading over there to see some Paralympics action as well. So that's kind of an exciting non-film related viewing for me coming up this week. But on to this week's new releases now. And first up, it's time for the return of the rings.
Sauron sees himself as master of all Middle-earth. He seeks to rule it not only through conquest, but by bending the minds of all its peoples to his own. And for that, he needs not armies.
No!
But rings.
So this is The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power Season 2. It's Amazon's mega-budget take on the world of J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle-earth, set a long time before the events of The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings saga as depicted in Peter Jackson movies. The first season premiered exactly 2 years ago, and it's now time for the second, beginning with a three-part episode premiere. Now, if you haven't seen the first season yet, there'll probably inevitably be some spoilers for that coming up, so approach with a bit of caution. But we'll try not to really spoil anything from the new series. But before Faye and I discuss the new episode, first we're going to hear from some of the key players who have made it happen. First up, you're going to hear Faye talking to showrunners J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, and then stars Charlie Vickers, who plays Sauron, as revealed at the end of season one, and Charles Edwards, who plays Celebrimbor. And if that wasn't enough, after that you'll also hear Megan Garside speaking to Morfydd Clark, who plays Galadriel, and Sam Hazeldine, who has taken over the role of Adar. So here they are now.
Every soul in Middle-earth is in peril. Will you abandon them to their doom?
No, what have you done to me?
Leave Sauron to me.
Promise me, Elrond. He will not stop until he is destroyed.
Forgiveness takes an age.
I need your axe, old friend.
Fight with me.
Fight with our friends!
I just wanted to start off by kind of touching on this thing you said about how Sauron is a point of gravity, pulling all the other kind of characters towards him. Is that kind of, in your minds, the main driver of season two?
Yeah, very much so. It's a huge ensemble cast. We've got, you know, storylines taking place in different, you know, nations all around Middle-earth. But if season one had a protagonist, it was probably Galadriel. Her journey was sort of anchoring the rhythm of the season. You know, if season two has a protagonist, it's got to be Sauron. So we have a villain protagonist. And, you know, his influence and his threat and his shadow is, you know, affecting or creeping into really every storyline this season. Actually, literally every storyline this season. And I think one of the things we aspired to do with season two in particular is, you know, you have this tapestry with all these different threads. And this season, you know, hopefully by the end, you really start to feel like it's actually one story, not many stories. And he is the tie that binds them all.
And we also get to see him in a very different form this season as Annatar. Are you excited for audience to see what you've done with that character?
We are. Yeah, I mean, yeah, he's so delicious to write. Other villains, they sort of see your weaknesses and try to exploit them. Sauron sees your strengths and uses them to his own evil ends. And particularly Celebrimbor, this is a tragic journey. I mean, Celebrimbor is played with such artistry and pathos by Charles Edwards. And Annatar comes to him and initially has to seduce him to kind of work his way into his good graces in Eregion, then ultimately manipulate him into starting to make the rings for dwarves and rings for men, and finally gaslight him. It really drives him towards insanity. It's a harrowing psychological thriller to go on with these two characters.
And if you're a fan of the books and the property and the lore, you know, hopefully you've been waiting for maybe even many years to see Annatar brought to the screen, and we're thrilled with what Charlie Vickers has done with it. I think you're going to hopefully be absolutely delighted.
And you mentioned how season one's protagonist was Galadriel and this one's Sauron. Obviously their connection between them is also really interesting and fascinating to a lot of audiences. When I spoke to Charlie previously, he said he thinks that they might be connected by their psyche, even when they're physically apart. So I was just wondering what you thought about that.
Sauron would think that. I mean, that's one of the places of real dramatic inquiry, season two. Sauron perceives her as a threat. She obviously perceives him as a threat. She's empowered him, and he like needed her to get to power. And that creates this really interesting dynamic between them. Season two, she's on her back foot. She feels incredibly guilty. To sort of earn back the respect of herself and her fellow elves, she's going to have to prove that, you know, she can kind of, you know, transcend past the version of herself that was vulnerable to his temptation and vulnerable to his deception. And the real question is, given that Sauron is over in Eregion and Galadriel's trying to stop him over here, they're on parallel tracks. What's going to happen when they inevitably collide at the end of the season? We're really excited for people to see.
And we've got this huge battle coming up as well. It takes place over multiple episodes. How long did that kind of take to film and put together? Was it very challenging?
So the Siege of Eregion is the big climax at the end of season two. It starts in episode six, goes through seven, and goes deep into eight. And, you know, each sequence is sort of a different phase of this battle. You know, siege battles take place, you know, historically not over a night or a day, but over months. And we wanted you to feel the weight of that. We wanted you to feel the layers of each of that. But also, it's not just action for action's sake, and it's not three episodes of wall-to-wall action. It is a battle that spans three episodes, and within that, there's an enormous amount of emotion. There are some amazing performances. All of our storylines and characters are sort of coming together. Rob Aramayo, who is, you know, been sent by his king to, you know, liberate the city. His character Elrond goes this season from being a politician to being a warrior and a general. You know, and if you know anything about the lore, the results are ultimately going to be tragic. And Rob's performance is absolutely spectacular and stirring. We're really excited for people to see. It is epic in scope and required a year of planning and preparation and many weeks of shooting. But hopefully it's quite emotional and even intimate at times when you actually strap in and watch.
And not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but we've spoken about this as a kind of 50-hour story. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of see that all as being standard episode lengths, or have you kind of thought about drawing from other shows like Stranger Things to kind of veer into feature-length episodes at all?
Yeah, I mean, it all depends on what the story calls for. You know, we have some longer episodes this season, and we have some shorter episodes this season. Middle Earth is very difficult to contain, and, you know, who knows what kind of, you know, journeys are ahead.
This season, we get into such a fascinating storyline with your characters that's so deeply rooted in canon. How much did you kind of get into the lore when you were researching it, and how much pressure was there kind of taking on this big moment?
Well, 100% immersion in what's available in the lore.
Yeah.
And what you see is pretty what much get. What's on the page.
Pressure, yeah. No, just excitement.
Because it's you know, we've been entrusted with this story to tell this particular very key story, and we've just been really, really looking forward to getting on with it and shooting it, and just very excited.
And you've previously said that you think that Halbrand actually cast a bit of a spell on your character when you first met him in season one.
Yes.
So Charlie, I was just wondering what you thought about that.
There's a lot of magic in Tolkien's world that's not very, it's quite ambiguous.
Yes, I think that's very true.
Yeah, and I think that there is definitely a moment in that forge scene where if it's a subconscious thing, but there is like a spark that happens, a creative connection between the two of them.
Yeah.
And it's the same, it's not just from Celebrimbor to Halbrand. I think, you know, Halbrand sees someone that he can relate to in terms of someone on his level. Creatively, I think the prospect of going back and putting this idea into practice is at the forefront of his mind at the start of this second season.
They also shot it in a way, when I saw that scene in season one, they shot it in a way that supports that theory. I mean, it's very studied and intense and closely shot.
Yeah.
And when I watched that, I was really happy with that, because you never know when you're filming something how it's, unless you know, constantly checking, you're never quite sure how it's going to end up edited. And that spell, Sauron's spell, I think, is sort of supported by the way they shot it.
And as Annatar this season, you also get to become an elf. Did you kind of lean on your co-stars for any advice? Did you give any about to be an elf?
Serious advice. There's some rules for being an elf.
There are.
And you have to abide by them. Or
not.
And you get fired. So Charlie was very sort of well-practiced, and you actually sort of developed... I say you're well-practiced, but you kind of disregard a lot of the rules.
Oh, I don't know if that's fair. Now, there are some rules that are, you know, at times, you know, you can kind of put them slightly to the side.
You can't look down is the first one. And there's...
There's lots of steps on that set.
Yeah, a lot of steps.
And lots of long robes.
Sometimes you have to hope that they cut around you looking down. Otherwise you're falling.
It all sounds very complicated.
It is complicated. It's a very good way of putting it.
And Charlie, just finally, I mean, in the latest trailer, we see the reunion between Sauron and Galadriel. It's a big moment for fans who'll be really looking forward to that. What can we expect from that reunion?
It is a big moment because it's kind of a reconnecting. It's like you see someone that you've known in your past and it's like, oh, so particularly as I look kind of different now, so it's kind of like, oh, so this is where you've got to. There's a huge amount at play for both of them and at stake. You'll understand when we get to the scene, but it's incredibly high stakes and there's a huge amount of urgency in each of them trying to obtain what they want in that situation, which leads to some, I think I can say, conflict.
What we've seen so far in the trailers, it seems like Galadriel is going to be in huge danger this season. Should we be worried how dark it's going to get?
She is in a lot of danger, as is the whole of Middle-earth, but she's got someone pretty bad who's pretty preoccupied with her, which is horrible Sauron. She's become the centre of an obsession. And that's terrifying. But she is this season back with her elves, which will kind of keep her safe and something that she kind of overlooked last time. So it's nice to find her back with her people.
And speaking of that darkness, Sam, on the surface, Adar seems kind of like the typical Dark Lord we're used to. But actually underneath, he's quite caring for the orcs and kind of like a father figure. Where do you think this emotional drive comes from?
I think, again, to take it back to Sauron, he was, I feel that Adar was duped by Sauron and Morgoth into becoming what he is now. Mm. And because of that, there are now orcs that he therefore feels a sense of responsibility for, because it's really, he sort of blames himself for not so much the creation, because he loves them, but the fact that they are used in the way that they're used, and not just by Sauron, but hated by the elves too, and there's nowhere for them to go. And so he feels a great sense of responsibility and duty.
Yeah, and we do have that in common, isn't it? We've both been duped.
Yes.
By Sauron. Yeah, by the deceiver. Good at that, yeah.
Yeah.
And in the trailer we've just got this week, we see both of your characters kind of team up against Sauron. What does this unlikely pairing mean for the season?
Well, I think it's it's sort of a needs must thing. We're really we end season one as enemies, Adar and Galadriel, and so it's like we have to think of something to do to combat the power of Sauron, because he's very, very much back in this series, and all of Middle-earth knows it, and there's a sense of panic and fear, and we have to kind of put our heads together to work out what we could do to create enough of an opposite force of power to have a chance to destroy him and for us to survive.
In an interview with my colleague, Charlie Vickers said he thinks that Halbrand and Galadriel kind of have this psychic connection. What's your what do you think of that theory?
I'd agree with him, and I think there is, like, they're both magical, powerful beings, that I think there is something lonely to existing in that kind of sphere that they both are. It's terrible to have misjudged someone as Galadriel did with him, and so I think that also kind of binds her to him, because she doesn't make mistakes like that, and he'll forever be the person who deceived her and tricked her. But yeah, there is some sort of cosmic connection, which I've heard Chai say a few times. I was like, nice, I like that.
Yeah, I think there's something really interesting about the fact that even though she knows now that Halbrand is Sauron, that there's a sense of loss there, that she's sort of has a hole there that where Halbrand once was. That even though she was deceived, it's really kind of twisted and dark and interesting. Yeah.
And what we've seen so far from season two, it seems like it's a lot darker, more scarier, more bloody. What is the grossest shot or prop or SFX makeup look either of you saw on set?
Well, there is lots of gruesomeness, because darkness is on the rise and they're behaving in a dastardly manner. But there's also loads of lush things,
yeah,
I will say as well. Like, the costumes are beautiful. Even lots of the scary baddies are, like, stunning, like... Mm. The moth ladies, I find kind of terrifying and fabulous and beautiful. So it's kind of all amplified in every way. Everything's gone into Technicolor in Middle-earth.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is grossness ahead.
There's a lot of grossness in the first scene of the series,
that's
actually.
True.
You know, it's really full on.
So that was showrunners J.D. Payne and Patrick McKay, and stars Charlie Vickers, Charles Edwards, Morfydd Clark and Sam Hazeldine on The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, Season 2. Now, I haven't seen any of season two yet. So, Faye, could you sort of set the scene for us and let us know where things are kind of standing when we start this season following the events of what went down in season one?
Yeah, of course. So, I mean, season two picks up pretty much straight after season one. And I mean, you mentioned that we'll be diving into spoilers. Kind of big reveal at the end of season one is that Halbrand is actually Sauron in disguise, and he's been manipulating Galadriel all this time. So we're kind of picking up in the aftermath of that, where Galadriel is really reeling from that betrayal, the feeling that she's kind of let down pretty much all of Middle-earth, and it's all hanging on her shoulders. While Sauron is kind of cast out by Galadriel and is picking himself up again. This season, we kind of see him take on a new form. He becomes Annatar, which is his kind of fair form, to try and influence Celebrimbor in the making of Rings of Power. So that's kind of the main crux of it. But this is a huge ensemble show. So there are so many other storylines as well kind of ticking along all at the same time. And it always kind of leading up a little bit to this feeling of darkness, much more than the first season, where, you know, like danger is kind of around every corner, and we're actually watching now, rather than having the mystery of who is Sauron, what's happening, we're kind of watching the kind of birth of him as this obviously iconic villain in Tolkien's works. So that's kind of the crux of it.
You've seen the first three episodes so far of this season. Like you said, it's kind of darker. How does it kind of compare in other ways to the first season, would you say? Is it sort of as epic because that one shot in New Zealand and this one famously shot in London, didn't they, in sort of studios? Can you feel that difference, or does it still feel very much grand scale?
I think it still feels really grand scale. I mean, they've done a really good job of kind of maintaining that feel from the first season as well. In terms of how it compares to the first season, I think inevitably the first season had a lot of time they had to spend setting stuff up. I mean, I mentioned it's a huge ensemble show. There are so many characters in it and so many storylines, and it was giving all of those kind of the time that they needed. So it meant that there were like some bits that felt very, very slow. These first three episodes, it's a lot of setting up again. They're kind of bringing it up to the point, like the first episode kind of focuses on the elves. The second brings in the dwarves. The third brings in the humans in Numenor. So, I mean, it has got a lot of similarity in that sense, but the pace does feel a lot quicker. And I think that really worked for me a lot more. We kind of get into stuff and get kind of right into the deep end really quickly, which I think is really good.
So is there much action in the first three episodes? Because with the first season, you could just see all the money on screen, really, couldn't you? And like the trolls and things like that felt like, you know, worthy of the big screen kind of thing. Does it feel like that this time as well?
Yeah, there's not a huge amount of action in the kind of first few episodes. There's a little bit. We do have like some pretty epic shots of orcs, and the kind of makeup and the work that's gone into that is still really clear on screen. You can see like the kind of epic scale of that. But no, it's very much a setting up thing. And I mean, the showrunners spoke about it in the interview, but we're all kind of leading up to this big battle that's going to draw season two to a close. So I think they are saving a lot of it for that as well.
And is it one of those things that do you very much have to have watched all of season one before you dive into this? Would you just be completely lost if you tried to start at season two?
I'm going to be honest, I think you would. I think even having watched season one, like when it came out a few years ago, I was a little bit lost at first getting back into it all, just because it's such a huge scale and so many different characters, and you're like, well, where's that character? There's a very helpful recap which I would definitely recommend watching, that kind of is on Prime Video as well, that you can watch.
Cool.
But yeah, I think I would definitely watch season one first. And also, just, you know, from what I've seen so far, it's just a really good payoff of that mystery that was all the way through season one, where you're like, who is Sauron, what's happening? And then the big reveal kind of end of season one, it really gets into it straight away in season two. There's a really cool opening monologue about Sauron, and I think, you know, for that to kind of make dramatic sense and to you kind of get the most from that, you really want to have watched season one all the way through.
So are there any sort of negatives you've run into in these first few episodes as well?
Yeah, I think it's just the same as what I struggled with a bit in season one, is that because it's such a huge ensemble show, some storylines don't work quite as well as others. The Half-Foots were one that didn't really work for me that well in season one, and they have mostly done away with that and really condensed it into just a couple of characters in season two, which works well. But the still kind of sticking point for me is Numenor and the men and the humans. I think it's just not, because it feels so disconnected. It's obviously very important in the kind of world of Tolkien, but it feels so disconnected from the main storyline. Mm. It kind of gets a bit forgotten, and those scenes are a little bit more boring than the other ones. So I am hoping that kind of picks up a bit more.
Does Tom Bombadil appear in any of the first three episodes that you've seen?
No, so he, as far as I'm aware, a little bit later in the season.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm really looking forward to see what they do with Tom Bombadil, because that character's so interesting.
Because that's Rory Kinnear, isn't it, is playing him. And he's someone that I've never actually, I read The Hobbit when I was younger, but I've always struggled with Tolkien sort of reading it. Even, to be honest, I struggle with The Hobbit, but I particularly struggle with Lord of the Rings. I've never read any of the, you know, the Silmarillion or Extra Material or anything like that. So I'm only really familiar with it from the films. But Tom Bombadil was someone that when I was younger, I'd had friends who did like Lord of the Rings. He was always a character that was mentioned. And I remember there being some upset that he wasn't included in the Peter Jackson films. But to someone who hasn't read the books, he just sounds fairly ridiculous. So I just was intrigued to know what he was going to be like in the show. But we'll have to wait and see, it seems.
Yeah, exactly. We'll have to wait and see on that one.
Okay, so that is The Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, Season 2. And the first three episodes are streaming on Prime Video now, with further episodes to drop weekly. Next up, it's time for something completely different, very much grounded in reality. It's a new take on the prison drama.
This is a clemency hearing for your conviction, 25 to life. Since you've been in custody, you've been involved in a theater program.
Gentlemen, let's go.
It's been a program that was established to help people get more in touch with their feelings and truly get some rehabilitation.
I am Gladiator Goliath.
I am Spartacus.
I'm Prince Hamlet of Denmark.
And it's turned into something, I don't know, wonderful.
What part do you play?
From time to time, I do act, like we all do.
So are you acting at all during this interview?
So this is Sing Sing, which is based on the Sing Sing maximum security prison in New York, and the sort of real life rehabilitation through the arts program, the RTA, that they have there, which is basically where they, you know, the inmates get together and they put on these drama shows as sort of something to do. And it obviously helps them get in touch with their feelings, gives them a sense of purpose. And in this film, the group is led by Divine G, played by Colman Domingo, but much of the group and the cast of this film are people playing themselves, people who've really kind of experienced this, gone through that program themselves. So there's that real sort of level of authenticity there, I suppose. And it's, yeah, so it's a very different type of prison drama, it felt like to me. Personally, I actually really love this film, and I really just got sucked into it straight away. Colman Domingo, I think he's just one of the sort of great actors working today, really. And this is just like a great role for him as this guy who's, he's obviously keeping all these people going, giving them purpose through his program, but he's kind of struggling with his own parole himself. He's been sort of wrongly imprisoned, and he's trying to get, you know, there's also an element that he's trying to get parole. He's trying to kind of get hold of this piece of evidence that could clear his name. But it's all very much we follow along with the inmates, so you don't really get a sense of the wider world. There's, despite what I just said about him trying to kind of clear his name, there's not really any sort of, you know, crime drama element to it like that. It's just, that's just a part of what he's going through. And also in the mix, what I really liked was Paul Racy, who you may remember from The Sound of Metal, and he plays the kind of the sort of acting coach, I guess, in a way, who helps them put on these productions. And as soon as he turned up, I was just like, oh wow, like, I just love this film even more now, because I thought he was just so great in Sound of Metal, and he's just got such a great sort of like on screen presence, and it's just perfect in that kind of, it's in some ways it is a similar role to what he plays in Sound of Metal, where he's kind of speaking to people who are going through adjusting to a sort of tough time and helping them sort of, you know, make peace with it and sort of find the best in it. So yeah, so I loved sort of having him back on screen again. Yeah, and I just thought there was just a real sort of authenticity from, you know, having these people playing themselves basically. It just, you know, it felt just felt very authentic. Didn't feel kind of over, it didn't feel like a documentary, but then it just didn't feel like that there was no sort of overacting or anything like that. But like, yeah, how did you find it, Facer? I've just waffled there, but how did you find it?
No, not at all. I'm just nodding along all the time. Completely agree. I really love this film too. I thought it was really beautiful and very emotional. It kind of crept up on me a little bit. I'm not sure I was the same as you were. I was in it straight away. I think it took me a little bit of time to adjust to it because you're kind of thrown in the deep end. You begin on stage, right, with Coleman Domingo's character performing in Midsummer Night's Dream. And then it's kind of slowly revealed about what this program is and they're bringing someone new into it. And it's quite funny and it's quite warm. And then it really gut punches you as you kind of go on. And that really kind of crept up on me, and it made me really quite emotional watching it all the way through. And I also just really love the themes of it. I think theatre is such a beautiful means of kind of escape. I know when I was younger, I used to love acting in plays and stuff. And I think that was one of the things that really helped me as a young person, like kind of develop confidence and stuff. And so that kind of theme of the fact that this is something that offers them not only escape, but also kind of meaning in their lives as well, I thought was really beautiful. I think like at one point, one character says they do it so they can enjoy the things that are not in their reality. And talk about gut punches, that's another one that got me as well.
Yeah, I actually in some ways had a similar experience because obviously I was like hooked in from the start, but then it definitely kind of sunk its claws further into me as it went on, really. And there's like it's interesting because obviously not loads happens because you're following this relatively small group of characters. Like I say, you're following them most of the time. You're not getting like a great sort of sense of the broader prison life particularly, or any of their sort of, you know, outside lives or what led to that. There's you know, not a film of flashbacks or anything like that. And it's sort of quite a specific time period really as well, for the most part, this putting on this one production that they're working on. But there's lots of kind of interesting things going on. And there's sort of a moment which I found really moving as well, was when they're kind of all talking about their best day basically. And it's there's just something really touching. And obviously, again, you can't help but like when you know that, you know, some of these people have really experienced this, you know, that does just add an extra dimension to it. But I found that bit really sort of touching. And then there's just other interesting things going alongside with some of the other inmates. And in some ways, the main kind of thrust of it is that there's this new guy, Divine Eye, he's known as, and he's again kind of effectively playing himself. He was an ex-prisoner who kind of went through this, and he's got a real kind of intensity about him. And you know, he's quite an intimidating character, but there's something really interesting in his relationship with Divine G, because he kind of comes in and he basically, because there's also like there's quite a lot of humor in it as well, strangely, despite all these kind of heavy themes, because there's just various funny elements to it. But one of them is that this play they put on, because they just throw all these ideas at it. It's just this big amalgamation of different things. And there's like a bit of Hamlet in there. But then there's also like sort of time travel elements, and they incorporate all you know, different periods of history and just random characters and time periods thrown in into this kind of slightly crazy mix. The new guy, Divine Eye, he sort of wants the role of Hamlet. So there's sort of kind of tension comes there really, because Divine G's kind of been the actor and the leader of this group. And so it's interesting to see sort of how that plays. And like I say, sort of humorous as well. So yeah, that I really enjoyed that. And yeah, there's certain things that creep up on you throughout it. So certain things are done really kind of subtly. Like there's sort of talk about when they go for their parole interviews, if they come away with like a thick sort of you know, envelope of paper, they know that's bad news basically. And if it's a thin envelope, they know it's good news. So that the way that's used really works well, and sort of subtly, just really, really kind of engaged in it, and sort of very moved by it.
I think that really worked for me too. I also, it does have the elements of like kind of talking about the problems of the prison system in America as well, but they're all handled so well, I thought. Like, it's kind of like just a subtle thing alongside it. Like the film, it is quite claustrophobic at times. A lot of the shots are kind of shown just small areas, or there's just like through a window, and this idea that the facility is on, I can't quite work out if it's on an island, but there's definitely water between where they are and where they think their family are. And there's something about that I just found really moving as well. So I just feel it really handled stuff like that so well. It's obviously very much like a film that is showing how great this rehabilitation program is in the prison. But those kind of elements allowed it to not be so sincere and kind of brought it back to that kind of like deeper issues that are kind of going on that I think really worked for me as well.
It's that weird thing that you do see some of the sort of tougher elements of prison life, like in the yard and things, but one, it's never really in your face. And so that in a way makes it, for me, felt like a different type of prison film, where so often the violence feels like it's very much like at the forefront, and the kind of constant sense of threat. Whereas this was just a different kind of thing, and a different look at the sort of community in there. Yeah, very, very interesting film, and a really great film, I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved it.
So if you fancy checking that out, that is Sing Sing, which is in cinemas now. And finally, it's time for another streaming series that's building on a very well-known movie world.
In a sea of uncertainty, only one thing is clear. Things will get worse before they get better. I need to stop Judgment Day.
So that was Terminator Zero, which is a new anime series coming to Netflix, sort of set within the world of the Terminator universe. And obviously, I mean, since James Cameron's original Terminator films, we've had lots in that world, including other TV series, which I never actually watched the Sarah Connor Chronicles, but I've seen all the films. I mean, I absolutely love the first two films. I love Arnie, so I'll always have something of a soft spot for this franchise, but I haven't really enjoyed a film since Terminator 2, like fully enjoyed. I've kind of there's elements I can like about most of them, except for Terminator Genesis. I just thought that was just irredeemable. But sorry, I'm going off on one anyway. But basically, it's a film franchise that obviously has a couple of classics and has gone off the rails somewhat over the years. So here we're sort of revisiting that world, but from a slightly different perspective. But it still plays with a lot of familiar elements to the Terminator world, if you have been a fan of those films. To sort of sum it up in brief, we're kind of on two timelines, in the sense that we see some characters from the future, one of the key ones being Aiko, who's a resistance soldier, and she ends up going back in time, as is kind of, often happens in the Terminator movies. And she goes back to 90s Japan, basically with the intent to save this character called Malcolm Lee, who's something like the equivalent of Miles Dyson from Terminator 2, in that he's clearly working on something significant. And what he's working on basically is a kind of AI that could compete with or neutralize Skynet, which is obviously the big AI system behind Judgment Day and the rise of the Terminators and the wiping out of humanity. Again, we've got another of those kind of classic Terminator stories of people going back in time to sort of save people, where there's also Terminators being sent back in time to try and destroy that person. So it's very much a different take on a timeline we're familiar with, really. And like I say, in this world, we're in the 90s, Judgment Day is approaching. So Malcolm very much feels like he's against the clock here. And it's interesting because it's sort of like a, I suppose, treats the 90s perhaps how we thought the 90s was going to be in the 80s, in that there's sort of basic robots and things around. So it's very much an alternate timeline in that sense. But that's the basic setup, really, without going into, too much detail. So it's, in many ways, it is a classic Terminator story, but obviously told in an anime style. I actually really enjoyed this. How did you find it, Faye?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I mean, I think I should preface this by saying that I like the Terminator films, but I'm definitely a more casual fan than a kind of diehard lover of that franchise. And I also haven't watched a great deal of anime before, so I think it was something quite new for me. So it took me a little bit of time to kind of get my head around it. But I did like it a lot. I think it's a really interesting idea to tell this kind of new story in this world, especially taking it into a new area and bringing it to Japan and developing that story. I think that was really effective how they did that. And I also just really like the kind of horror elements of it. I thought it was quite scary. The animation kind of really lent itself to that kind of storytelling, I thought, with the kind of dark red storms and so forth, and also just the kind of violence. I thought it worked really well in that sense, and I enjoyed that element.
Yeah, I thought that as well, because again, as someone who watched the original Terminator like way too young, you always forget that obviously that was pretty scary in its day. And Terminator 2 has scary elements, including one thing that's repeated here very graphically, which is the sort of nuclear blast and the sort of skin peeling like skeleton left. But obviously, because of doing it in animation, they just take it that much further. So there's definitely that, and that threat hangs over the film in a sort of quite disturbing, unsettling kind of way. And again, it's that weird thing that I always find it slightly hard to judge violence when it's animated, because obviously you are slightly, you know, slightly removed from it. But it is very, very violent. There's obviously, I mean, lots of shooting, lots of different weapons. And then there's also lots of like Terminators kind of showing their strength by crushing
off arms.
Crushing heads, ripping off arms and things like that. So it's pretty full on in that way. There's lots of things that, like, if you are familiar with the films, there's lots of, not in a way that I found really like intrusive, but there are lots of callbacks. There's kind of musical references you kind of will notice. There's obviously the, like, you know, there's the nuclear blast thing that I mentioned earlier. There's kind of a Terminator doing self-surgery on its arm that very much calls back to the first film. There's like a police station raid at one point, which again made me think of the first film. And so there's lots of stuff like that. But yeah, it's like an interesting different take. And I should specify that I watched the, and I believe you did too, but I watched the English language version, because it's sort of a Japanese-US co-production, as far as I can sort of work out, where it's kind of developed and written by Mattson Tomlin, who he kind of did some apparently uncredited work on The Batman. And he's working on a Batman Part 2. Yeah, he's sort of written this, developed it, executive producer. And then it's directed by Masashi Kudo, a Japanese animator who you may know from Bleach, the animated series. That's his kind of most famous work. So it's kind of an interesting mix of the two. And you can, on Netflix, you can watch it in Japanese language as well. There's a relatively starry voice cast in the US dub. So you've got Timothy Oliphant as the main Terminator, although in classic Terminator style, he doesn't actually really speak that much. So
the fact that he gets top billing is kind of a bit missing.
It is a bit misleading, actually, because you don't actually hear him speak very much at all. And then you've got Andre Holland, who's voicing Malcolm Lee. So again, probably best known for Moonlight. So he's this scientist who's developing his own AI. And this kind of AI that he's developed, Kokoro, is voiced by Rosario Dawson. Then Aiko, the resistance soldier that mentioned previously, is voiced by Sonoya Mizuno, who is kind of best known probably for her work with Alex Garland. And also she's in House of the Dragon as well. And finally, another recognizable voice is Anne Dowd, who plays the Prophet, who's kind of like this sort of, you know, philosophical leader of the future resistance. She kind of gives some talk about timelines, things like that. Another thing about it, we're talking about it being kind of quite graphically violent. It's quite sweary as well, in a sort of enjoyable way.
She gets a good moment of kind of swearing. Mm. That it did take me out of it a little bit.
But it's certainly not for kids, you know, so don't get sort of misled and think this is like an animated series. Let's chuck it on with the kids. So it's kind of, the choice is yours whether you watch it in sort of English language or Japanese. We watched it in the English language. And yeah, so like I say, on the whole, I actually really did enjoy this a lot. There's a sort of element of people get split up somewhat, because basically Malcolm has got kids. And so that's used as a sort of leverage point, in a way that Terminators think that might be a good way to get to him. So then he's got three kids. They end up getting split up a bit, and Aiko's in the mix. And there's also another character in the mix, Mizaki, who is effectively like the children's nanny. And again, you sense there will be something kind of a bit more interesting about her past as things go along. But she's another kind of key figure here. And she kind of gets a bit split off as well. So there's a few different threads running through it. Some really, some sort of nicely done action, some very kind of stylish visuals. I'm not the biggest binger myself personally, but I actually did whip through this all pretty quickly without any sort of complaints, but if I did draw a slight negative, it could have been streamlined in certain elements. I feel this with a lot of TV shows personally, but some of the stuff, particularly with Malcolm and Kokoro, where he's kind of trapped in this room, sort of talking to this big AI animation effectively, well, there's some interesting stuff in there, but I felt like that there was almost a bit too much time spent on that over the course of all the episodes, especially watching them in a fairly binged fashion. I felt that could have been trimmed back a bit. But I mean, that was a kind of a fairly minor complaint for me. I actually did just really enjoy this overall.
Yeah, no, I'm similar. I mean, I did enjoy the kind of philosophical and moral quandaries that they were discussing, and especially in kind of talking about AI and humanity. And I do think it's all very timely. So I did enjoy it, but I'm the same as you. I think that it definitely could have been streamlined a little bit. And it did start to feel a little bit repetitive after a while. But again, that might just be kind of, I mean, I binged it as well, the same as you. So it might have been the kind of nature of watching it that way. And then, I mean, we kind of alluded to it by saying that Timothy Olyphant doesn't really speak much, but I could have done with a little bit more Terminator in it as well.
Yeah.
I think there are some, like, definitely some good scenes, especially as the series goes on. But, you know, you're watching Terminator Zero, you kind of want quite a lot of Terminator in it.
And because, and it starts on, like, a cool Terminator action scene as well. This, you know, the Timothy Olyphant one comes into it and has some cool moments. But, yeah, I do agree that, I felt like there could have been a bit more. But like you say, I actually did think it was interesting that, because of, again, the time of a series, that it was interesting exploring a different part of the world, for one thing, because you kind of take for granted with the other films that, like, obviously it largely happens in the US, but you think, obviously, it just affects the whole world, really. So it's sort of interesting to, you know, to think about how it impacts the rest of the world. And also it does give them more time to dig into some of those, like you say, those philosophical quandaries, such as, like, you know, the questions about the greater good and what sacrifices are worthwhile, and if, you know, killing people in the name of saving humanity, and those kind of questions, which I thought it handled quite interestingly. You definitely, I mean, just by the very nature of it, you kind of obviously get the sense that they could carry this on and expand it further. And I definitely would be intrigued to watch more.
I also really want to find out what happened to the robot cat.
Yes, I know. That's another interesting part of it as well. We need to know. But if you fancy checking that out, that is Terminator Zero, which is streaming in its entirety, all 8 episodes on Netflix now.
I'll be back.
So we're almost at the end of the podcast now, but Faye, what is your show or film of the week this week? Do you have a sort of favourite out of what you've watched?
Well, I've been dreading this question. Mm. Well, am I allowed to draw? I really love Sing Sing. So I feel like that if I was recommending anything, I think I would recommend Sing Sing. But kind of from my heart of hearts, I just love The Rings of Power so much. And I'm so excited to have that back. So I think that might just edge it. I don't know. What about you?
Well, I obviously, because I haven't seen Rings of Power season 2 yet, I'm going to have to say Sing Sing, with the caveat that I haven't seen Rings of Power, but I'm very much looking forward to catching up with it. And kind of getting that sort of long form investment in that world really again. But Sing Sing for me, film of the week. But we're approaching the end of the podcast now. And just a quick reminder that our Beetlejuice issue is still on sale. And you can also now read our review of that film online, fresh from the Venice Film Festival. And if you enjoy this podcast, we'd love it if you could rate it and subscribe on your app of choice. And remember, you can contact us on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. We always love hearing from you. But before we go, just time for a quick question tied to Terminator Zero. Faye, is there a film that you would like to see get an anime spin-off?
Yeah, I was trying to think about this because I think anime, what it really does so well is bringing something that's really visually interesting to the screen. So I'm going to kind of punt for another James Cameron special and say Avatar. I guess particularly Avatar 2, I would love to see. And I'd just love to see how they handled the water tribe. I think it could be so cool to watch that in anime. How about you?
For me, I thought I'm going to go for something that very much I always saw as a sort of companion piece to Terminator, perhaps because I just watched them at the same time and there's certain parallels you can draw. But RoboCop for me, because it just felt obvious thinking of like just how you could do the action and the sort of, you know, just the visuals in anime. And then it was one of those things. I absolutely adore the first film and I feel like it has so much potential, but I mean, I haven't seen the second one in years, but I remember quite liking it as a kid, but obviously it's not that highly regarded. And then I remember the third one being terrible. And they weirdly as well, I have just the faintest memories of the TV series, which again, I also remember being fairly terrible. So I'd love it, the chance to do a series that explores the world more, but isn't kind of restricted by budget in the way that you felt like the live action series was back in the day, that just couldn't compete with what they could do in a film. So I think that you could get all that action. It could be pretty sort of gnarly and violent. And even I think it could just kind of work, because I would just kind of quite like seeing RoboCop doing like a weekly sort of procedural show, really, and
dealing
with different cases and stuff. So that's my pick. Please do RoboCop Zero next. But that's all from us for now. And until next time, goodbye.
Bye.
Get your ring out.
Don't wear the ring. I know it's very tempting. Yes, you will appear to disappear, but the Dark Riders, they'll know you're there. Yes, Lord Sauron has many spies.
Many spies have many eyes.
One needs to find them, to find them. One needs to rule them all. One needs to find them, or to find them. One needs to find them.